I'm Bob Boylan with a Plus One podcast from All Songs Considered. There's a new fascinating collection of songs coming from producer Sam Cohen and from Brian Burton. You may know him as Danger Mouse, or you might know him from his band Broken Bells. The 18-song collection is called Resistance Radio, The Man in the High Castle, and the music is inspired by the original Amazon Studios series called The Man in the High Castle. The premise of the show, based on a 1962 novel by Philip K. Dick, imagines an alternative world in which the Allies lose World War II and the United States is taken over by Nazis, who control one half of the country, and the Japanese, who control the other half. Bob Bowen of Amazon contacted Brian Burton to put together a new collection of songs, but they're songs from the early 1960s. The soundtrack includes performances by Sharon Van Etten. Also, there's music from Beck, Nora Jones, Angel Olsen, Kevin Morby. On this Plus One edition of All Songs Considered, I talk with Brian Burton about how these songs were recorded and compiled. It all began in New York City, and there was a deadline.
I'd been working with Sam Cohen, who's an artist and producer as well, a lot in New York, just in his little studio in Brooklyn. I said to him, I said, hey, there's this thing with this television show, and I don't know, it takes place in 1962, and so all the songs would have to be before then. It'd be a covers thing. It doesn't really sound good on paper, but if we could make it the way we want it to and get whoever we wanted to sing on it, maybe this would be worth doing. Let's try this out. So before I committed to it, Sam and I went into the studio with his with some great musicians that he works with, and we tried it out. We went in at like 5 p.m. And I picked 3 songs. I think it was Motherless Child, The End of the World, and trying to think what the other one would have been. Maybe it was I Only Have Eyes for You. So, but we went in and just to see what it would be like. And so we cut 3 songs live in the room with everybody.
Was Sam the singer?
Sam would run people through it just so that people knew where they were. But we weren't really recording the vocals so much as just going through the songs and recording the backing tracks for them, just with the backing band. So we didn't bring in strings or horns or backing vocals yet, or even we didn't even know who was going to sing what song yet. Okay. I just wanted to see. Oh, and the other thing I didn't mention is that we had to do the whole thing in a month, which was insane. So I was like, well, if we can do these 3 songs in one night, yeah, and this is the way people used to record stuff, you know, you get really great players and you go and you just knock it out, then if we could do that, then maybe this could get done. So we went in and it sounded great. We did 3 in one night.
Instrumentation was?
Yeah, upright bass, drums, piano, and guitar. And that's how we started it.
Did you play them, let's say, the Skeeter Davis song, or did you play?
Yeah, we would have done that. Yeah, sure.
I'm going to give people an idea of the tone here. I'm going to play the Skeeter Davis. I'm going to imagine that we're in that room on that night, on that 3-song night, and for the musicians, you played this.
Why does the sun?
Yeah, this song just gives me chills, and we're going to play in a minute the Sharon Van Etten version and talk about how you got there. But I don't imagine anybody in that room was old enough to know and be there when that song came out. But when that song came out, because I was, and it came out in 62, it was right around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was a crisis where many people thought we were about to hit World War III, and it was going to be a nuclear war, and we were all going to die. And that song and the lyrics and the title, I mean, there were people building bomb shelters, and it was such a tone in the country at the time. It's very intense.
And it's funny because when we first did this, there was a huge list of songs, you know, that they recommended, but we didn't have to stick to any of them. Mm-hmm. But it did give us some good ideas, and then we bought some in, but they gave us, you know, the creative control. We could do whatever, really. And that song in particular, I always really loved that song. And there was this version of, I don't know if you remember, Claudine Longet. The French.
Her doing it now? I don't know that.
Yeah, it's her voice. Her English isn't that great, so it was really kind of a cutesy voice thing. But there was a really great different arrangement that went along with it that gave me the idea. Well, with a lot of these songs, there were multiple versions of them, so you could see what version someone else did really well, like 4 or 5 years later or something else, and take mm-hmm. the best parts of things and then just kind of redo it with a whole different voice. But the thing was, it's a dark show, and it's about a dark time, and it kind of was starting to mirror what I think a lot of people were feeling when we did this. I mean, we were recording this in December.
I see. So elections had ended.
This is post-election.
You're in
yeah.
New York City.
Yeah,
with musicians.
It's a whole thing. Yeah, and right. so the good thing was I like darker, sadder music anyway. But a lot of music at that time was kind of a little. This is 1962 and before. There was a lot of happier music, but I wanted to kind of steer towards the more dark side. But based on the subject matter of the show, it worked. Mm-hmm. You could do a mostly dark record because it was a dark time, and it's a resistance radio thing. It's a pirate radio station thing. So that's what helped us to kind of pick the songs we wanted to use.
For those who haven't seen the show, the first episode, for example, opens up in a classroom, and there's music playing in the background. That music is not coming from resistance radio, this right? Explain
more. I think in the second season there are some times when it is.
Okay.
And they make hints towards it without giving away the show or anything like that. But that this music is being done in places that you can't really see and that are kind of underground bars, and that there's a pirate radio station, and that this is part of the station would be these songs. And so we just thought, well, as long as it sounds like, and we're not trying to do updated versions of them by any means. It's just, get a little time machine. You create it by in the studio doing it, recording a certain way, technique-wise, and which Sam Cohen is really, really good at. Then you just kind of transport somebody back to that time and see what they would have sounded like singing then. It's kind of like doing a film. You can get the sets and you can get all the costumes, and then you put the actors in that position, and can you believe you're in that time? And that's how a lot of people kind of learn about those times and those periods. And musically, I thought it was interesting. It's not nearly as expensive as doing it a film, but I thought it would be a challenge. And it really was that first night of cutting those three songs and listening back in this little studio in Brooklyn. It was like a practice space. We had to keep stopping while other people were jamming next door really loud and, with their guitars and rock band rehearsals, just to do this quiet music in between. And just when I listened back to some of the backing tracks, it just felt like you were there. So I was like, all right, this is gonna be a challenge. How do we get the vocalist in there to do it and then add the stuff on top of it, the strings and, which we layered over and over again, even though it sounds kind of big. We only used, I think, three or four string players. And it was a challenge and it was fun. And we had a deadline, so I knew it wasn't gonna be something that dragged on and on and on and on. We just had to go in and just do it.
Well, then walk me through, since we're talking about the end of the world and we're talking about the tone that you were trying to get, tell us how you put Sharon Van Etten in that seat of now it's 1962, long before she was born. What did Sharon come into? Did Sharon come into a live band? Did she come into a track that was laid down? Walk me through all that.
So I'll walk around your question,
okay,
and you can ask details after. But basically, no, we went in and we cut all the songs first. So once we did that first night of the three songs, we committed to the project, and then maybe a week later, we started getting together a list. Sam and I would sit down. I mean, we spent hours and hours listening to tons of songs and versions of songs and what we were going to do and how we were going to do the arrangements and things like that, and then we spent in it just 4 days or 5 days, like a 4 or 5 day, Monday through Friday kind of thing, going in every day. And we cut another 15 songs, just the backing tracks with the same group of musicians. We had Jared Samuel playing all the pianos and vibes and organs. And then Sam Cohen was playing the guitar. John Shaw did all the bass upright. A lot of it was upright bass. And then we had two different drummers. We had Ray Rizzo, and we had David Christian, these great, great drummers. And just, we only switched up drummers, that was it. But that's what we did. It was just us meeting up every day, doing three or four songs a day until we had 18 backing tracks. And then they took off, and that was it. And then Sam and I then started reaching out little by little, the first person I reached out to right away was James Mercer. He and I were just happened to, you know, we're in Broken Bells together, and I was telling him about it, and that was actually the other song that we had done was
Is that the Taste of Honey?
Taste of Honey, yeah. That was one of the first three we did. So I sent him that, and he sent it back the next day, or 2 days later.
So he laid his vocal on top of what you and Sam put together.
Well, Sam did it first, so because we did it a different arrangement than that had really ever been done, there was an idea how it would be done. So Sam recorded his own vocal as a placeholder, and then we sent it to James, and he was in Portland working on Shin stuff, and he took time out and did his own interpretation of it, which was different than Sam's, but was very much something great. It sounds like James in certain places, but there's many people that I played it for that most people just don't know it's James, really, which just happens on a lot of these songs. It's just the way he interpreted it and that style of singing, it just changes his vocal. In the meantime, we were, myself and Sam, and mostly Sam at this point, because of, we were kind of divvying up the jobs, I was getting in touch and working with getting a lot of the vocals done, and he was helping get together the arrangements for strings and horns and backing vocals. So those were being worked on and being laid down over the backing tracks in the meantime while I was getting the vocalists to try to put their performances. So sometimes we'd get a vocal performance before we were finished, mm-hmm. before we had recorded the strings or the horns or anything like that. And sometimes, you know, some of the people came later on. It took a little while to get certain singers to stop on tour and go to a recording studio or meet with me in Los Angeles or in New York with myself and or Sam. So it was different for each one. So I was not actually there for Sharon. Sam knew Sharon, and they both live in Brooklyn. So while I was working on something in Los Angeles after we had cut the tracks, he was in New York, and she came in and sang it. And she was probably the second or third vocalist to record the track, but that was definitely the one. When I heard that vocal of hers on that track, is when I knew that the potential of this, and just seeing how someone, you know, she could have been a big vocalist in the 60s easily. I mean, if this is the kind of style of music she wants to sing, she can do it. And I think that there's many instances on this record where that came through.
Let me play some of Sharon Van Etten's performance of The End of the World. I know you say you weren't there for Sharon when she did her performance, but in general, what would you say to musicians when they came in to tackle the song, to capture?
Yeah. It was different each time. For Sharon, that was Sam in there with her, and, you know, everybody generally knows the Skeeter Davis version of the song, so it's a good starting point. The backing track's a little different; it's a little bit more dramatic, I think, the one that we did. Mm-hmm. And I find it's usually best to let people do whatever they're going to do. And then if you have something to say, say it afterwards so you don't get in their head too quickly. Let them, you know, they'll probably come up with a better idea than you had anyway. So you don't want to infect them with your half-baked idea or whatever. You just don't know what somebody else is going to think. So most of the time, the discussions about what to do only came if they asked or if it or after they did a performance. There were a few where when they did it, it didn't quite work in some way, but all of them knew that it wasn't quite working, and then that's when the direction kind of came in.
I wonder, and again, you weren't there, I wonder what Sharon thought, having sung in a style, it's a bit different than what she does, and certainly the musical tone is certainly different. Reactions from other musicians, maybe Beck, or maybe the Kevin Morby, or maybe, especially
when
you were there.
All these, I mean, the Beck track, very, 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 very different for him. The thing is, though, it's not surprising that these people can do these different styles.
I guess I'm just wondering what they thought. I mean, here they are. They're just put on a costume, right?
They
walked down a street they hadn't walked down. I'm just wondering if you remember any particular reaction.
Well, what I was doing was, because this was a hard sell, I think, you know, asking people to do classic songs that have already been done, that stood the test of time, that are, you know, that's not an easy gig. And you kind of, you know, I just wanted to convince them that I'm not setting them up. You know, you just don't want somebody to do a bad version or a not as good version of something that people know. That was the real discussion beforehand. It was like, look, if we don't pull this song off, if we don't do this, if this just sounds like this, then we just won't use it. But this is an attempt. We're going to try to do this. And we really did prepare. That's why we did so many songs. We did not plan on having 18 songs. We probably planned on having about maybe 13. Things could have definitely gone wrong on some of these songs. But we recorded 18 and we used 18. It's just that's what it wound up being. It just, there was a feel to the whole thing. But what you're talking about, I guess the response, you know, I was sending people 4 or 5 songs that were already done as we were going in order to convince them to do it. You know, for somebody like Beck or Michael Kiwanuka, I'd send them the Sharon song. I'd send them Sam Cohen singing House of the Rising Sun, you know, the Shins doing Taste of Honey, so they could see themselves what this could be if they do it. And that is really where more of the discussion came from. I haven't really got a chance. This happened so quickly. I mean, I've sent out the whole album to people and, you know, everybody's really kind of happy and blown away with, I guess, just kind of how it all, because they hadn't heard all the other songs. All they heard was their 3 minutes. But when they hear all these songs together,
it's amazing.
It's been really, really great to have people's reaction on that.
Some of these songs, and you say that you don't want somebody to do even a mediocre version of one of these classic tunes. Kevin Morby tackles what I think is one of the most beautiful songs ever.
Yeah, that was tough. That was really tough because, I mean, it's not even just such a great song, but the recording is so amazing. And the song, I Only Have Eyes for You. But the most famous one being by the Flamingos,
Let me just play a touch of the Flamingos for those, because lots of people don't know this. And then we have a tone here, and then I'll play Kevin's, who did a great, everything about it, the arrangement you and Sam did, and then Kevin's performance is great. But here's a tiny bit of the Flamingos.
Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright. I only have eyes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
All right, so let me play Kevin, which is pretty great too.
To be a kind of blind love, I can't see anyone but you. Shabab, 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 shabab.
Shabab Shabab. All the stars out tonight. I don't know if it's cloudy or bright.
I guess that's kind of the stoned beat poet version of the song. That's
what it, though.
And that was the approach. That was very much Sam and Kevin. Sam produced the last Kevin Morby album,
And
they've been working together a lot. And so they had a really good relationship, the two of them. So when it came time for the vocals, the two of them kind of got that together, that style and everything. So I was actually kind of surprised. That's the thing about this, you know, some of these, when they came back, I see a demo pop up in my inbox, and I've stopped wherever I'm doing to run, you know, to get my headphones in and around some quiet or plug it into a stereo, because I have no idea what's about to happen based on, you know, where the person recording it was. About half of it was done with myself or Sam. The other half was done because people were all over the world. You know, Michael Kiwanuka was in London. Angel Olsen was in North Carolina. Other people were on tour. You know, Beck was in L.A. So you just didn't know what was going to happen.
What do you think is the characteristic that defines the era of music that you've now spent a bunch of time listening to the original recordings of, and then sort of remaking that sound? How would you describe that?
Well, I mean, I definitely learned a lot from recording it, you know, this way. It reminded me, for myself, the only thing close to it had been doing this album I did called Rome, which was getting musicians to play in the room, all, you know, live takes, but very kind of meant to be a backing track for a vocalist. Whereas a lot of music I do, the music is big and sounding, or it's bombastic or something. It's a big part of it. Whereas this is a setup for a vocalist. I mean, these vocalists carried the song. They were the characters. They were the artists or the singers or the people that basically sold the records. You were selling a person to the audience. So these songs had been recorded, like the one we just heard. I mean, I Only Have Eyes for You had been recorded a ton of times before the Flamingos made it into that. You know, these songs were just vehicles for people or for bands or for groups in that way. And so it was very craft oriented. So the band that we worked with was really, I mean, they know their music so well and were such great musicians, as were probably the people back then, that they only had to hear the song a few times. And we're talking about and playing back songs that are pretty famous, but there are a handful of songs on this album that nobody had heard before. And so them listening to it, interpreting it, and then going and next thing you know, you have a recording an hour and a half later, and you're on to the next thing. It's just very, very different. It was just the compartmentalizing of the songwriting, of the musicians, and then of the singers. You could see how people were just turning it out, you know, just one after the other, and then, you know, the good stuff sticks. But they really, when they did stick, you could use that song every couple of years with a different vocalist or a different group or whatever, every few years, and you know, it can make somebody else famous in 5 years, and nobody would care. It wasn't there wasn't any kind of I don't know, the culture that was anti or negative about doing something like that.
Yeah, it was an era that changed when Beatles came along. I think
yes.
That people, I mean, but at their beginnings, they did A Taste of Honey, and they did songs that were other people's songs, but they made you write the songs and sing the songs you write, something that became defined the next generation of songwriters and singers. But before that, it was, you hit the nail on the head, which I hadn't really thought about. It was all about the singer.
Yeah, I mean, even the Dylan factor, I mean, being, you know, him being so influenced by, you know, a specific couple of singers where he was just taking the songs and doing them. I mean, that's how people learned how to write songs. And I just don't know. I think some people do that now, but I think based on, you know, if you're making music with a laptop or nothing wrong with that, or a computer in your bedroom or whatever, it would have been the thing where you were sitting there with a guitar or a piano or trying to figure out how somebody did something. That doesn't happen anymore, for better or for worse, or at least right now it's not happening as much as to, you know, where you get your chops from, I guess, for songwriting. It's just a little different right now. But people are listening to lots of, you have way more things to pull from. So, again, I'm not sitting here saying something was better than that.
That's
I'm just
right.
saying why it's
it
different.
It just was.
It's just why it's different.
Yeah. I love that. Were you there with Beck when he did his?
I was not, but I will say I was with Khalees. Like I said before, when we were doing all these songs, recording them, you know, Sam would just tough it up and just go, all right, I'll sing it, you know, and these are not all songs that Sam would ever be comfortable singing, but he just did it anyway, and he would send out scratch vocals of the recordings, especially on some of the songs that people didn't know. And there were two instances. There was one where he sent one over for Khalees, and that was, oh gosh, what song is that?
She did Who's Loving You.
Who's Loving You, right. So, yeah, so Sam, that's these are the two instances. So Sam did Who's Loving You, and, I mean, yeah, it was unlistenable almost, but he had to do it. And, you know, he felt really bad about doing it, but we had to do it. And it really came in handy when I was working with Khalees on the song. I'm sure he wasn't happy about
it. Let me hear a little of this. Funny because the sound of these are like, well, first of all, it sounds like everything's taking place in the same room. In other words, the guitar doesn't have one reverb and the piano another. The EQ on it sounds like it's coming off the record or the radio. I don't know if that's with intent.
Well, yeah, we did. We had to cut. So we recorded it using the modern thing of using Pro Tools, but we did record. There was bleed on all the tracks, so we didn't try to isolate too much.
For those who don't know, bleed means that all different sounds are coming in all different microphones. There's no isolation to the recordings, which makes it...
It's subtle, but you can tell. There's something to it when it all comes down to it. And then when we were finished with it, when we mixed the album... we used a lot of older equipment to put the songs through. But then when we were done, we pressed it onto vinyl. And then when we were done with that, I mean, the vinyl sounded great, but the other version sounded a little clean, a little hi-fi, so we just mastered it off of the vinyl. So the version that you're hearing is coming off of a vinyl record, which takes a little bit of the shine off of it in a way that it just sounds more accurate to what we were looking for. It's just something that was necessary. But the one time though, when Sam did a version, we were going to try to get Michael Kiwanuka or somebody else to sing House of the Rising Sun, and Sam sent me the demo, and it was him singing on it. He had already done a song called Get Happy, so his work was done as a singer, but he sent me House of the Rising Sun to pass on. And as soon as I heard him singing it, I just thought, I'm not passing this on. I'm just going to use that right there. Don't even re-sing it, like your demo of it. He just went for it. And with no intention of it coming out, I think if he knew that was his song, he might have even approached it differently. But he just sang it, and just, you know, sang his heart out on this song, just as a scratch vocal. So we wound up using that one.
Let's go out on Sam's version of House of the Rising Sun. Good talking to you, and thanks for doing this.
You too. I'm glad you like the record.
Yeah, I do. I really do.
I'm thinking, who knows? I mean, maybe, you know, maybe there's a 1965 in there that could be getting really interesting. Do this again.
Brian Burton, he and Sam Cohen produced Resistance Radio, the Man in the High Castle album. It's out April 7th on 30th Century Records. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call I know. they call the rising sun. In going back to New Orleans, my race is almost run. I'm going back to Spain.